You have reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave your message after the tone.
Hello, Flora. My name is Jessica. I'm calling because I was watching with my kids The Secret, The Life of Pets, and we live in New York City, and we were wondering how many animals have they found in the subway or the sewer lines. Thank you. Bye.
Hi, Flora.
Hi, Jessica.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good, good.
Are you on the subway a lot?
Daily, yes. It's my commute.
From where to where?
From the Bronx to Manhattan.
How long?
Oof. Hour 15 each way.
Ooh, so you spend a lot of time on the trains.
I do. That's why we had the question, because we're always taking the subway everywhere. And also because my kids watch The Secret Life of Pets, and there you can see this fluffy bunny living underground together with a bunch of piranhas and tarantulas.
Welcome to the Underbelly Brothers, home of the fleshed pets.
So we were wondering, even my kid was asking me, ask Flora if there's any stray dogs and cats and cobras hiding, lurking under New York. I said, okay, I'll ask her.
What animals are they interested in?
My little one, he's 7 years old, and he's interested in all kind of animals. I took him to the zoo one day, and there was this big roach, you know, the ones that look Madagascar roaches, I think they are.
Oh, yeah. Hissing roaches, right?
Exactly. They're super big. And he wanted to hold it so badly, and he said his favorite animals are rats, so you take it from there.
Jessica, your son is going to love this story. You asked what animals live in the subways and sewers, and we have just the person to answer your question.
My name is Jason Munchie South. I'm a biology professor at Fordham University.
Jason studies urban dwellers, the animals that live in New York City.
There's all sorts of cool animals that are, making their way back into the city. Foxes, raccoons, skunks, possums. There have been the odd river otter here and there.
Really?
Jason has also spent a lot of time studying the animals below ground. He spent months going deep into the subway system to figure out what lives there.
Brave.
And first things first, Jason said, you shouldn't imagine the cast of a Universal Pictures cartoon riding the rails.
No. Any animal larger than a rat that is living down there, it's probably temporary and would have been brought by somebody and let go. You know, the famous sort of myth is that there are alligators living down there. I'm almost certain there have been alligators in the sewer system.
Really? Like in Florida?
In New York.
In New York. Really?
But I'm equally as certain that they were brought by people and they put them down there and they didn't live there very long. You know, they might be able to survive like a couple months when it's warm, but then they either die or people find them and get them out.
Not every animal can cut it down there. It takes a special kind of creature to thrive in a lightless, polluted, scorching hot in the summer underground tube.
Roaches.
Yep.
Rats.
Yep. If you're interested in that kind of wildlife, which Jason is, there is a lot to see. In fact, Jason had a story for you about a subway animal encounter that makes him shudder to this day.
Ooh.
Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Stand clear of the closing doors, because there's no turning back after this.
So one day we were doing this study on rats to look at how they move through the subway and also how they move from the subway to above ground.
And the station Jason was surveying was 34th Street, Herald Square.
Of course. There are lots of rats there.
That's exactly what Jason said.
34th Street, Herald Square is the worst station by far. That's common knowledge. I mean, you don't even have to go behind the scenes to know that there's a lot of rats and cockroaches in 34th Street.
Next time you visit New York, ELT listeners, something to put on your itinerary. Okay, so Jason's at the station.
And of course, there are rats everywhere. It was almost like a clown car where you see them running in a straight line down the tunnel when they see us coming. And you can see evidence of this. You know, they leave these grease trails and all sorts of things.
Like pizza grease?
No, the rats actually produce an oil on their fur. It's like a waxy, oily substance that keeps their fur and hairs in good shape. And they follow the same paths, and they like their body to be touching because they actually have these long hairs that give them some sensory information.
Like tummy whiskers?
Yeah, exactly. They're like essentially whiskers on the sides of their bodies. So they can move around in, you know, very dark spaces because of this. But they produce this oil called sebum, and when they follow the same path over and over again, they leave essentially a grease stain that builds up over time, and you can see it quite easily. You can even scrape it off when it gets thick.
Were you scraping for pleasure?
No, it's one way to, just to confirm that it's actually the oil that's building up and not just, you know, some other stain.
Dream job.
Yeah. It's kind of like, it feels like Vaseline that had been, you know, spread on something and then left to kind of dry out and thicken a bit.
I can't believe rats are actually grosser than I thought.
Yeah, there's always something extra, right? Always something extra.
Jessica, the grease trail is something you could look for next time you're waiting for the train.
I don't think I'm going to do that. It sounds really disgusting.
It gets worse.
Really?
Much worse. Jason and his team followed this rat trail down the platform
to an old bathroom, but it has this like prison bar gate. If you've ever seen any of the Saw movies or similar horror movies, it was kind of like that setting. And there's no lights anymore. So we shine a very strong flashlight in there and it illuminates an old sink. And there are literally like three or four rats just sitting in there.
Like a hot tub for rats?
Yeah, there was no water, but they're just sitting in there. And then they see us, and they get scared, and they start going into the drain and disappear into this sink. And then the next thing we notice is that we were so focused on the rats, we didn't see the broader view. But then we start looking around the room, and the wall is kind of moving and shimmering.
We'll find out why the wall was shimmering after the break. So we left off with Jason standing at the end of a subway platform, peering into an abandoned bathroom, when he noticed the walls were moving. Jessica, any guesses about why the wall was moving and shimmering?
Oh my God, don't tell me. It's roaches?
The wall was covered, coated.
Oh my God.
In cockroaches.
Almost like wallpaper. The air is thick. You can feel and smell what's coming off of them in the air from decaying food and feces and humidity, just sort of all mixed together.
What did it sound like?
There wasn't a lot of sound beyond the rats squeaking to one another and their claws like scurrying on the sink. The roaches don't make a lot of noise that I could hear, at least. I mean, you can, if you're up close to them, you can hear them moving around, like rustling their legs and wings a little bit.
Oh God, I didn't get lunch before coming here. No, it's gonna be difficult. You know, rats are not so bad for me, but roaches, I wouldn't be able to sleep for a year if I see something like that.
It stuck with Jason, too.
I have seen a lot of things like this, but this was one of the worst. And because, you know, we were on a narrow part of the platform and there were other people behind me, I was kind of stuck there. And there's this, I don't know the name for it, but there's this kind of automatic response you have when you're disgusted by something like that, where you kind of shiver a little bit and you feel almost like they're crawling on you, even though they're not. That's what I felt. And I haven't felt that very often because I'm used to this sort of thing, but that was like to another level.
Rats and roaches are the kings of the subway system. Every train is the R train.
You said it.
And Jason said, the reason these animals rule the underground is because they are exceptionally good at living off the subway's primary resource.
Garbage?
Exactly.
If you see a lot of rats in a station, it usually means that they have access to some resource like that, like some motherload of garbage.
All those trash cans you see on the subway platforms, they get emptied into a big garbage room in the station. And you can imagine what that trash room must look like to a rat.
Heaven.
Exactly. Now, besides the garbage cafeteria, we do feed some underground fauna even more directly. And this brings us to one more subway dweller you need to know about.
There's a mosquito down there that lives in sewers and subway stations called Molestus.
Molestus, really?
Yes. And the reason is because it's been known for a long time to attack people. So it was famously noted during World War II in London when people would go into the tube stations to hide from bombings and they would get voraciously attacked by these mosquitoes. And then it's since been introduced to New York and Chicago and all these other places with big sewer systems and underground infrastructure. And they don't go into torpor over winter. They're just active all year round for the most part.
Good for them.
Yeah. And I have a hypothesis that we haven't been able to test yet, that their primary prey are rats. So they're basically feeding on rat blood and humans are just secondary. But I don't know that for a fact. It's just a hypothesis.
It's a disgusting circle of subterranean life. There are spiders that dine on the mosquitoes, beetles that feed on the rat carcasses.
There's a whole food chain down there.
Jessica, that's the secret life of subway animals. Rat grease trails, cockroach wallpaper, year-round mosquitoes, and the spiders who eat them.
Oh my God, now I'm not going to ride the subway. Oh my goodness.
Do you think your kids will like the story?
Yeah, they will love it.
Jason, for the kids out there, maybe Jessica's kids who want to study biology, how do they make sure to avoid this career trajectory?
I thought I avoided it. I was a tropical biologist, and then I moved to New York City, started studying animals that live in parks, like nice, furry, cute, native things. And all anybody wanted to know about was rats. I will say, if you want a stable career, knowing about rats and how to control them is actually not a bad trajectory. There's lots of need out there.
Next up, more questions about life in underground tubes, but we're leaving the city for the prairie.
I just finished listening to your Pink and Blue episode.
And you mentioned prairie dogs probably 800 times, and yet not one single prairie dog fact.
Now I'm in a prairie dog loop.
You're going to do an episode about prairie dogs now, right?
Lori, you got to help us out.
ELC listeners, we hear you. We made an offhand analogy about prairie dog towns, and you called us out for not giving you a single prairie dog fact. Well, today your thirst will be quenched. We are bringing you a P-Dog Bonanza, everything you need to know about these little chicken nuggets of the prairie.
I love them, and I hate to say that, but they are. They are the chicken nuggets of the prairie. Everything eats prairie dogs.
This is Jennifer Verdelin. She's been studying prairie dogs for the last decade, and she has got the facts y'all have been craving. Let's start with a quick lightning round. Where do they live?
From Saskatchewan all the way down to Mexico. They love grasslands. Where there's grasses, you find prairie dogs.
How many different species?
There are 5 different species, and they are endemic to North America, which means they're only found here.
Generally speaking, what do they look like?
Well, so they sort of have a shape like those Russian nesting dolls, you know?
Round in the center?
Yeah, and a little bit rounder on the bottom. So
round all the way around.
Yeah, except at the neck. They kind of taper up there.
What's their personality like?
Suspicious, mischievous, and a little bit frantic. They have real drama in their social lives. It's a soap opera out on a prairie dog town.
Jennifer has spent weeks watching the Prairie Dog Channel from dawn till dusk, and she says Meerkat Manor has nothing on the Real House Dogs of Prairie Town. There is infighting, cliques, literal mudslinging?
I was out in Colorado, and there was this one prairie dog with another prairie dog, and I think they were having some kind of issue because the one was just kicking dirt and basically burying this other prairie dog, and he was just sitting there taking it. And I just thought, stand up for yourself. What's going on?
Maybe he deserved it.
Maybe he did, but still, it went on for about an hour.
How should we picture you in this scenario?
Well, I was sitting in a comfortable camp chair with a mug of coffee, snacks, and my binoculars and tape recorder and video camera and, you know, basically camp out from 6-7 in the morning till 6-7:30 at night.
Jennifer is the perfect person to school us, and she says if you want to be prairie dog literate, you have to know the ABCs of prairie D's. Let's start with A, which unfortunately stands for almost gone.
Over the last 100 years, their population has declined by 99%.
99%, wow.
And that's true for all five species. The Mexican prairie dog has been listed on the International Endangered Species List since the 1970s. The Utah prairie dog has been listed since the 1970s. And through a combination of disease, development, and persecution, the Gunnison's blacktail and whitetail prairie dogs have similarly declined, but efforts to list them have failed.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Letter B is less of a bummer. B stands for badass burrows. As we mentioned in our Pink and Blue episode, prairie dog towns are way more complicated than rabbit holes.
Oh, for sure. It's completely more complicated than a rabbit hole. In fact, rabbits live in prairie dog burrows. So there you go.
What other animals do you find in prairie dog towns?
So a lot of insects like stink beetles or dung beetles, small rodents like kangaroo rats and pocket mice. You get snakes, burrowing owls, badgers, and the weasels and the ferrets. So it runs the gamut.
Prairie dog city. It's a melting pot down there.
It is. There's a ton of diversity.
How big are prairie dog towns?
Well, historically, they were huge. They would go on for many, many, many miles. Most of them now are fairly small. Like, you could go maybe like a mile in one direction and maybe a half mile deep. And you would have, gosh, maybe like 400 prairie dogs. So within a town, one thing I should say is that it's subdivided. So not all of the prairie dogs interact with each other. It's kind of, you know, think about it like neighborhoods or different social groups that don't talk to each other.
Okay, so there's a town, and then within that, there are underground burrows that are like neighborhoods.
Yes. Now, not every burrow is connected underground, but many of them can be.
So what does it look like underground? Should I be imagining like a hotel, like a hallway with lots of little rooms or...
Well, so this is a fascinating question. We have very little knowledge. There's been a few excavations. I did one with Gunnison's prairie dogs. And it varies, right? So you don't really have little rooms, but they do have like a latrine area. And the tunnels are basically wide enough for one prairie dog. And I found these little pull-offs. So I imagine if there's two prairie dogs coming and they're going in opposite directions, you need a pull-off to the side to make room. I'm imagining. I have no knowledge. We have no cameras underground. They don't take kindly to anything being shoved into their burrow and will attack it and destroy fiber optic cameras in a few seconds.
Wow.
So, yeah, they don't go quietly, right? Everything eats them, but they don't go quietly about it.
And that brings us to letter C. Prairie dogs are chatterboxes.
There's always a lot of talking going on a prairie dog town. They're talking about everything incessantly. They're like, cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha-cha. There could be alarm calls. Bop, 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 bop. And their calls are so specific. So they can identify coyote, dog, fox, cattle, elk, mule deer. They got words.
They have specific chirps for specific animals?
Absolutely. And then it gets even better than that. They have specific chirps for specific individuals within specific animals. And they add adjectives to that. So, you know, for example, it's like Joe the Coyote's coming over the ridge at a clip of about, you know, whatever the pace is. We've also shown that they code color. So one of the experiments we did is we had people, the same people, walking through with different colored T-shirts. And you're able to see that with the same person wearing a different T-shirt, the call changes slightly to account for the different color. And this is in the blues, yellows, and greens. They don't do red.
And is it consistent? So if you're wearing a blue shirt, the call is always the same?
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go. Prairie dogs have a lot to say. They build vast underground homes. And now would be a good time to start caring about them because they're going extinct.
They're true underdogs.
This episode was produced by Aaron Reese, Phoebe Flanagan, Annette Heist, and Flora Littman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Our consulting editors are Caitlin Kenny and Jorge Just. Mixed by Dara Hirsch. Scored by Dara Hirsch and Bobby Lord. My favorite movie is The Secret Life of Me. Goodbye.